You're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you have a question about your animal's behavior, give us a call now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. In addition to the calls, we have another special topic to share. And what are we talking about today, Patricia?
Well, we're going to talk about some new research examining whether animals really know how to self-medicate when they become ill.
Interesting.
This issue, it's never been studied experimentally, and it's going to be fun to talk about it.
Yeah, and it'll also be fun to learn about the interesting history of pets in America with an author who wrote a book about that very subject. Her name is Catherine Greer, and she'll be joining us in just a bit. But first, we have some calls. Let's go to the lines. 1-800-462-7413, the number. Hello, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Stephanie from Wasilla, Alaska.
Stephanie, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have this bit of a dilemma. My husband and I got married last August, and we have a blended family. He has two cats, and I had two cats and a dog.
Oh, my.
Yes. So in addition to getting used to each other, our pets are getting used to each other. And actually, I've used some advice that I've heard from you on previous shows, and it worked beautifully.
Oh, well,
that's why we
let you on the show.
Yes. But my problem today is that, as I'm sure you can imagine, my cats are angels.
And, of course.
And they never, ever get on any countertops or tabletops, things like that. But his little devils have taught my little angels a few things. And so, especially at night, one or more, we aren't quite sure who, get up on the countertops and have knocked over vases of flowers and, we don't leave food on the counter, things like that.
Good, yeah. But still...
We're having a problem.
There's so much fun stuff up there. Let me ask you one question. Do you have a variety of vertical opportunities, as we might say, if we were selling, I don't know, military equipment or something? Because cats love to be high. You know, I remember being in Africa, and not my vehicle, but other vehicles in my party had cheetahs literally jump on top of their vehicle with their tails hanging down inside the vehicle, because cats love to get up high, and that was the only high thing on the Serengeti. So do your cats have a lot of chances to get up high?
Yes, we have a climbing tree, actually.
Good.
For them, and we have, they're allowed on the couches, things like that. We actually have one very timid cat, and she really prefers to live 90% of her life on top of the cabinet on top of the refrigerator.
Oh, sweet.
And we have allowed her to do that.
Yeah,
so
good for you.
She can jump up on one part of the counter, and we feed her up there, and, she comes down for when the dog is away. So really, those two opportunities are the only, close to ceiling opportunities.
Gotcha. You might want to, I would do a couple of things. I would increase the opportunities to get up high, maybe get another couple of cat trees. Mm-hmm. You don't want your entire decorating scheme based around cat trees, but you can be very creative and come up with all kinds of fun, pretty ways to do that. The tricky thing about the counter, I was going to suggest that you use something like a scat mat, which is just a little plastic mat that you plug in. It gives a little, it's like a carpet shock. It's not an abusive shock in any way. But, carpet shock is enough to get you to go, ooh, what was that? And that's usually enough to teach cats to not jump up onto counters. There are other things you can do that are basically sort of self-correcting. But I like that. That's one of the best ones because you don't have to be in the room. They can work really well. But the problem is you've got this one cat who does jump on the counter. So if that cat only goes up onto one area of the counter and then jumps up onto the top of the fridge, you could use scat mats in the other areas. I'm a little worried that that might not be true. And if this little scaredy cat gets up on the counter and then drifts off to the right or something and gets inadvertently one of the little carpet shocks, then what's she going to do?
Yeah.
The other possibility, I would love to hear what listeners say about this.
We actually have a pet tip on it.
Do you?
Yeah.
Well, let's hear.
We have a pet tip from Jane in Grand Island, New York, who says if you want to keep pets or cats, off furniture or other surfaces where cats don't belong.
How appropriate.
She places a large piece of heavy-duty aluminum foil on the area, the furniture or whatever, or in Stephanie's case, the countertop. Apparently, the cats don't like the noise it makes as they prance across it, and they also may not like the feeling of it under their paws.
That does, in my experience, it's a good tip. That does work on some cats. It doesn't work on others. Some of them actually think it's sort of fun. I've had cats who like to urinate it on, actually.
Oh.
But no, aluminum foil is often very effective. Another similar kind of idea is you can get some of those indoor-outdoor carpets that the bottom is a little nubby, you know, sort of little nubby teethy-like things, and you sort of turn them over.
Mm-hmm.
Cats often don't like that. You can also spray the counters with a citrus-smelling spray, which a lot of cats don't like, and that's sort of nice for you because then your kitchen smells like oranges. And what I was also going to ask of our listeners is, everybody raise your hand who just, lets your cat get up on the counter. Trisha's hand is raised at the moment. Larry, did your cats, were they allowed when you had...
They got up wherever they wanted to.
Yeah.
Brad, our engineer, raised his hand to get everywhere.
There are many hands raised here in the studio. So truly one tried and true problem-solving perspective that professional animal trainers take is to redefine something as a non-problem. So that's another perspective. And what you might want to do is say, okay, I'll just give that up and not worry about it. But in exchange, honey, I want you to fill in the blank. So this might be your chance of, you know, I don't know, getting that hot tub you wanted.
Good luck. Thank you, Stephanie, for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number. By the way, how do we people get pet tips
please,
to us?
Yeah, please send us your ideas. We love to hear from you. And who knows, we can't read them all on the air, but we might read yours. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And let's take another call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Brenda calling from Hartford, Wisconsin. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Well, Brenda, thank you for calling. How can we help you?
Well, we have a pug terrier mix. He's about 2 years old. That is from a rescue. He's been with us just 6 months. Came with a lot of issues, but he's making tremendous strides. Big problem right now is we do a lot of camping, and we take him and our cat Izzy with us.
Okay.
And we like to go canoeing, and we like to go to the beach if they have one, stuff like that. He's with us a lot on the trails, does a lot of hiking with us.
Yeah.
But we can't take him to those areas around the canoe. So we've tried leaving him in the camper, and, of course, he just barks and barks and barks.
Oh, he's panicked.
I've tried the special treat thing, but he won't touch it until we come back.
Is he panicked in the house when you leave him?
Yes, but he's gotten a lot better with that.
Okay.
And I find that a lot of times when we come back, the house is quiet.
Good. Do you own this camper? Is it in your backyard when you're not camping?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. Here's the trick to getting the treat trick to work.
Okay.
Does that make sense? If you just give him a treat and then leave, he's going to be so scared he's not going to want to eat the treat, because one of the things we know is that one of the first symptoms of adrenal production and cortisol in the blood is appetite suppression. So the trick to getting this to work is to create situations where you do the first thing and only the first thing that you do before you actually do leave, but you don't actually leave. So what you do is say you're going to leave the camper. Think about what would you normally do. Maybe put on your sandals or get your beach towel or something like that. So let's say he starts to get nervous when you pick up the beach towel. Well, pick up the beach towel and then throw him a piece of food, really good food. Just one little piece, or give him a stuffed toy with food in it. But then you put the beach towel down and then you pick up, maybe there was a Kong or something, a little hollow. There are lots of brands of hollow toys now. There are a million of them. They're great. So you got this little toy and stuff with food. So you throw it down right after you pick up your beach towel. But then you put the beach towel down, then you take the Kong away. And then you repeat that like 10 times in a row. And that's it. That's your training session. So then you gradually work your way up. And the trick is the gradually part. You gradually work your way up to picking up the beach towel, walking to the door, and then you give him his treat. And you do that 10 times in a row, but you don't actually leave. And so you keep increasing that and step by step. So you open the door, and then you open the door and you stand outside for 2 seconds. And the key to this, which is not intuitive at all, is to spend the most time, it usually takes 4 to 6 weeks, spend the most time on the beginning stages of this. If it takes 6 weeks total, you're going to spend 4 weeks getting up to just standing outside the door for 10 seconds. Because once you've got him okay for 10 seconds, then it's easy. It's easy to get to 60 seconds and then 5 minutes and then 10 minutes. And think about when you're leaving somewhere. Have you ever gone on a trip and just felt like you were ripped away from your home and your animals? And I feel that way every time I travel, which is a lot. I mean, I really have a hard time when I'm driving away from my farm and my dogs and my cat and my sheep. And I really suffer. And then once I'm on the plane, I'm fine.
Yeah.
So it's that actual transition that's the hardest. So work the hardest on that part.
And good luck. And thank you very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, we'll find out if an animal's ability to self-medicate is going to put some veterinarians out of business. I doubt that. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets.
Major support for Calling All Pets comes from Dog Tired, the home of American-made premium dog beds, featuring a build-a-bed option where customers choose shapes, fill, size, and fabric options. Designed and tested for man's best friend in Black Earth, Wisconsin. Dog Tired. Information at dawg-tired.com.
I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Before we take some more calls, we have some great new research to talk about. And Tricia, is it true? Do animals really know how to medicate themselves when they feel ill?
Well, you know, we've observed animals for decades doing what appeared to be self-medicating.
Yeah.
I mean, there are several examples. There, common chimpanzees eat a leaf from what's called the bitter leaf tree, Mujanso leaves, and they eat these bitter leaves only when they have a really high parasite load.
Oh, interesting
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And chimps, same species at Gombe, Jane Goodall Station. They eat a bitter-tasting plant in the sunflower family. It's very bitter. They don't even eat the whole leaf. They just chew the juices out of it, and they spit out the leaf. Doesn't seem to taste very good, but they do it when they have a high parasite load. But there's been no experimental evidence. This is all observational evidence. But recently, a scientist named Villalba conducted the first true experimental study to see if animals really can self-medicate themselves.
Now, that'd be interesting to design a study like that.
Yeah,
What did it involve?
Well, he used one of the world's finest animals. He used sheep. Bless their hearts. Not always considered to be the smartest tack in the toolbox, right? And he gave them grains that were laced with substances that would make them a little ill. Not really, you know, not that would hurt them in small doses. He gave them things like tannins, which, you know, make them feel a little off, and oxalic acid. And then in the experimental group, after he induced this feeling of discomfort, he then gave them a grain that was specifically laced with some kind of medicinal compound that would make their specific problem feel better.
Interesting. What did they feed the control group then?
Well, that's the right question to ask, because good science requires a control group, right?
Yeah.
So in the control group, the sheep were fed grains that would, again, make them feel a little bit ill.
Yeah.
But they weren't given the substance right afterwards that would make them feel better. They were at some point in time, they were given all these same substances. It was sort of mixed and matched. So there was no correlation between what they ate and what would make them feel better.
And what happened ultimately?
Well, what happened was that after sheep had a chance to learn or not to learn that something might make them feel better, they were given food again that made them feel a little sick, and then they were allowed to choose. You can choose grains with this compound in it, with that compound, you know, with another compound. And what happened is the experimental group, the one who had a chance to learn that, you know, compound A made you feel better from illness A, they indeed went back to the grains that had the compound that made them feel better. And the control group just ate willy-nilly.
So in other words, the sheep learned that certain grains cured whatever ailed them. And not only did they remember what those grains tasted like, but they also remembered the grains that made them feel better.
Exactly. And that's the key because, again, we've talked about sheep not being, you know, quite as smart as primates, although I actually think they get a bad rap. But nonetheless, they were able to remember that by eating a particular compound, they would feel better. So that's good supportive evidence that indeed animals do seek out particular plants that make them feel better. So they can indeed, in some circumstances anyway, self-medicate.
And a kind of a neat research design as well.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Using the world's best animal, a sheep.
Well, one of the best, anyway.
One of the best.
And, you know, we have some of the best listeners in the world.
We hope they don't need to self-medicate themselves.
Here on Calling All Pets. And here's the number to call, by the way. It's 1-800-462-7413. And here is one of those great listeners. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
My name is Bob from Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Bob, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
We adopted a Katrina rescue dog back in September.
We all are applauding and cheering.
Yay.
You.
Oh, and her.
Good boy, good boy.
She's a brave girl. And the world is kind of a scary place for her, but we've loved her along, and she's really come out of her shell and just become a great dog. She's
good.
Integrated with our other dog and our two cats, one of whom thinks he's a dog. And keep him away from the radio so he doesn't hear that he's a cat.
Right.
But Sasha got sick about a month after we got her, and we took her to the vet. And in checking her out, they did an X-ray, and they found a piece of buckshot in her hip.
Mm.
And now anytime she hears popping sounds, even if I just close my eyeglass case, she'll start, if she's on a leash, she'll jump up on us, she'll dance around, panicking. And I'm trying to figure out a way of, you know, desensitizing her to the popping sound.
Yeah, good question. And, you know, you're describing what is regrettably relatively common, which is that animals can become sensitized to stimuli, which means that they get more and more sensitive, even to really low levels of whatever it is that scares them. And particularly animals who've been through two traumas. We know from post-traumatic stress disorder in humans that two traumas are very often sort of the enough. It's sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. Mm-hmm. So there are a couple things you can do, and one is physiological, because basically she's now in a hyper-reactive state because she has had these traumas in the past. And so her whole brain chemistry is different than it would have been beforehand. And so part of looking at this is looking at her physiology. The least intrusive way you can try and do that is by lots of exercise, which, as we all know, can be very calming. If that's appropriate for her, your vet obviously can tell you that.
She loves to go to the park.
Yeah,
and run.
Good. So lots of that is really helpful. It's not going to cure, but it certainly helps. That DAP, that dog appeasing pheromone, is just come out in the States in a collar form.
Really?
And I would highly recommend giving it a try. They can't get real wet, so you have to take it off if it's raining or before a bath. I would try that. You could also try the diffuser. And the other thing to do is to try that desensitization that you mentioned, that basically counter-classical conditioning. Those are actually two slightly separate things. Desensitization is just exposing her to gradually increasing levels of popping noises. So you get a tape recorder. You'd want to move the speakers around because if she might just learn that it's okay out of the speaker, but not another, you know, not other noises.
Do it in surround sound.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And still, you start really slowly. I would suggest bumping that up to what's called counter-classical conditioning, which is presenting a very low-level popping sound and then instantly doing something she absolutely adores. So give her a piece of chicken. So it's low-level pop chicken. So combining all those things might have a significant impact on her. And if it doesn't, then I would talk to your veterinarian or particularly a veterinary behavior specialist who's experienced with using anti-anxiety medication just to help her get over the hump if you feel that it's necessary.
Mm-hmm. And good luck.
Yeah, good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And good for you, Bob. Thanks very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello there. My name is Peter Berg. We live in Jupiter, Florida. It's on the East Coast, north of West Palm Beach.
Wonderful. What can we do for you?
Well, you know, many people have cuckoo clocks. We have a cardinal clock. His name is Henry II.
Yes.
And between 6:30 and 6:45, punctually every morning, he comes pecking on our dining room window.
Actually,
he's not very particular about which window. He's just pecked on mine right here in my office. It's rather funny. I see his wife sitting on a branch outside. Her head is twisted sideways, and she's looking, saying, "What is this bozo up to?"
Oh, those guys.
Well, you must be wondering why he's called Henry II. Well, we have a Henry I. A friend of mine used to live in Charlottesville, Virginia, and that's where he met Henry. Walter told me that one day he counted Henry doing 52 consecutive pecks.
Oh, no.
Then he gave up counting.
Oh, no.
So I asked Walter, I said, what was the solution? Oh, he said, we sold the house and moved away.
There you go. Well, there you are.
Then, there you are.
And so why are you calling us?
Well, I tell you... We hadn't quite planned to do that. We've tried brooms, waving, shouting, and everything. We've even tried putting our attack dog out. But the attack dog prefers cats, other dogs, squirrels.
And pays no attention to Henry II.
No, no. And the trouble is he's a Yorkshire, and it's a little bit high-flying cardinals are not quite in his
league. A little over his league, perhaps. Well, you know, I actually had a similar problem, but for the first time in my recollection, with an oriole. I had a male oriole attacking my window, actually attacking his reflection in the window, which is, as we know, what your male cardinal is doing.
Yeah.
But I've never had an oriole do it. And they are indeed just relentless, aren't they? It's sort of amusing, except you worry that they're going to hurt themselves, but you can just see this feedback system. I mean, the cardinal fluffs up, and you know the other cardinal fluffs up too. And you know, then he makes a little display gesture of "I'm going to attack you," and the other one does the same thing. And it's just like two boxers in a match. That what's most successful is to put something in the window that eliminates or decreases the reflection, or put something inside. Like some people put stickers inside that. Make it clear to the cardinal that that isn't just air.
There is some material that you can place over the windows that actually you can see through very well. It's a very fine netting, and you can purchase it at your garden center. It's very inexpensive. You can tack it up on the
outside
on top of the window, and it just blow it down. You can see perfectly fine, but the cardinal. Henry II.
It's like a fence almost, right?
Yeah.
And that it's just he physically can't actually get to the window.
He doesn't get it, and it really
and they
doesn't
don't get
take
tangled
up.
In it, right?
No. They don't get tangled in it. So you just attach it at the top, and the bird, you know, will leave it in your windows alone.
Do you remember what that's called? I don't.
I'm trying to remember what it's called, but it's if you go to any garden center and ask them and describe what you're after, they'll know.
But you know, we have about 30 windows.
Well, I try it on the main windows and just see what happens.
Yeah. Might be sort of fun to follow him around, see if you can... Well, you said there's a female watching him with her. Yeah.
I think it's the same couple who nested twice by our front door.
Ah,
we have two
little
ornamental trees there, and they nested on each one. They've even been there again, and he even left a signature on one of the panels.
Maybe he's just trying to impress his lady.
Maybe.
Sort of a guy thing to do.
He might...
Sorry. Speaking as a biologist, of course.
Peter, thank you.
Good luck.
Well, thank you so much.
Appreciate it very much. Oh, boy. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, we'll talk to an author about the history of pets in America. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Even man's best friend has a fault or two, so bring out the best in your pet with advice from Patricia's dog training books. Whether you need help with a multi-dog household or you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, you can find the information you need online. For a selection of books and training guides available for purchase, call the radio store at 800-747-7444 or log on to our website, callingallpets.org.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week, we welcome Catherine Greer to the show. Catherine is the author of Pets in America, A History, an interesting book published by Chapel Hill. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The term pet is considered kind of controversial today,
it
as a
sure
matter
is.
Of fact. Yeah, it can be used to describe an animal that's essentially a member of the family, or it can imply ownership or possession, that sort of thing. What did the word pet mean, say, 300 years ago?
Well, it was a rare word, but when it first appears, it actually is used to apply to people. And to children or to court favorites or individuals who received special attention and care, and the implication was that they were spoiled. Then by the 17th century, you find it being used for orphaned lambs. So it originally applies to sheep as an animal and then eventually starts to apply to other animals. But in the 18th century, in the 1700s, the term that most people would have used to describe an animal we think of as a pet is the term favorite.
Favorite.
Oh,
yes,
interesting.
They would have said my favorite.
My favorite. Oh, that is very interesting. You know what people call orphan lambs now is bummers.
Oh, yeah.
I like pet much better.
Much better.
That's were they, much more fun.
Were they the first pets in America? Describe the first pets in America.
Well, the first pets, first of all, when European settlers came over here, they brought with them traditions of keeping animals not just for work and utility, but also for companionship and pleasure. So really, the first pure pets in this country were probably caged birds, and they remained, I think, the most popular pure pet really into the beginning of the 20th century, and this was partly because they were sort of the radios of their day. They were the ambient music in your household.
It's a great perspective.
Then what you do find, though, is you find companion dogs. Quite early on, I found a lot of interesting lost dog ads from the 1700s where people say, I have lost Juliet, my spaniel, you know, and things like that. And they have wonderful names, oftentimes human names.
Well, you know, that brings up the fact that as our lifestyles have changed through history, our relationship with animals has also changed. I'd love to hear you talk about how the role of animals in our society has evolved over time.
Okay. People in the past lived in what I call multi-species communities. They required animals for the materials that their bodies gave, meat, leather, horn, all the kinds of things that they got from their bodies. They also required animals for energy, for the energy that they provided, horses, oxen, and other kinds of animals that could be used for the purposes of work. Now, they also had pets at the same time. That's one of the things that I found is so interesting, was that families made the discrimination. They would have some animals that were pets and some animals that were working animals. And this really was the case, and it changed very slowly in America until the 1920s. And then you see an acceleration of, you know, pets as being the only kinds of animals that ordinary people have contact with. And that's the situation we're in today, unless you're involved with feeding wild birds or some kind of wild animal rescue or something like that. Chances are the only animals that you have any kind of relationship of care with are the pets in your life.
You know, now switching gears a little bit, nowadays owning a pet requires a pretty healthy financial investment.
Yes.
You got vet bills to the cost of food, you got pet toys, other gadgets. We end up spending a lot of money on our animals. How did the pet industry, kind of lucrative for some people?
Well, one of the things that's so interesting about the pet industry when you study it is that it's one of those industries that it didn't cost very much to get into. Nowadays, I think the costs of getting involved with some parts of it are like food are more expensive, but the people who make those cat dancer toys, I would venture to say they're probably still making them on their kitchen table.
Not a huge investment.
Yeah, exactly. And you find that in the past, too, that it's a small business that people who, for example, make wire strainers will also make bird cages. And really, the beginning of what I would call kind of modern consumer products for pets appears when a company called Spratts begins to market dog food, first in England and then in this country. And what Spratts figured out, their product looked a lot like hardtack, the biscuits that soldiers ate, and had about the same appeal, I think. But one of the things that they figured out was that the secret to marketing was advertising. And that's where you start to see more expenditure going into creating pet products, because more and more money starts to go into marketing and creating national brands that get advertised in magazines like the Saturday Evening Post and so on. I mean, that's really how kitty litter got launched, because Ed Lowe, the guy who founded the company in the 1940s, figured out that if he put ads in the Saturday Evening Post, that that would do a lot to build his market for a product that people didn't recognize that they needed.
Is Spratt still in business, by the way?
Spratt's is in business in England, but it left the United States, I believe, by the 1950s. I've had a little trouble finding exactly when it left this country.
Catherine, do you find some people just a tad judgmental about how much people spend on their pets? I'd love to hear you talk about that for a minute.
Well, I found that through the whole project. You know, as I was doing the research, and people would ask me what I was working on, you know, and I would tell them, and they tended to have one of two responses. One was that they were thrilled by the subject, and of course they had to tell me all their family stories.
Yes.
So I got, you know, waylaid a lot at parties, and my husband learned to sort of slink off, you know, and sort of disappear. But the other thing that I got was people would say, Americans are so wasteful, and they're spending all this money on pets they should be spending on people. And I began to say, wait a minute, what other form of expenditure that we associate with our leisure hours are you that judgmental about? Cable television? Golf? You know, the amount of money that the average family spends on its pets is considerably less than it spends on electronics in a year. And I would venture to say that electronics manufacturing does a lot more damage to the environment than pet keeping does.
Right.
You say in your book that pet keeping today is shaped by the continuing human desire for novelty. I think I just about a direct quote there. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a lot of things that shape pet keeping. Our desire for emotional attachment, simple pleasure, and sort of watching animals do their thing. But I also think that one of the things that we see is this sort of interest in novelty, and you certainly, which drives the market for consumer goods generally. And you see that, for example, in this sort of restless search that we see all over the world for new dog breeds, where they're looking, constantly looking for, you know, the next Shar-Pei. And so there's, and then those dogs, in some respects, become almost like a fashion good that become a fad in their own, you know, themselves. We certainly saw that recently with Chihuahuas and teacup dogs, and I think that's still kind of the case with them.
And cat breeds. Don't you find cat breeds as well?
Yes.
It amazes me how every month there's a new, often mutation.
Yeah, and some of them are worrisome. I would say the Munchkin is a very worrisome development.
I agree.
Because that's a real deformation.
Given all that, what do you suppose the future holds for pets in America?
Boy, that's a good question. I mean, I do think that we're on an arc where you're going to see the continuing expansion of the practice. But one of the things that's going to be interesting is as America becomes, has more people who come from cultures who have less pet keeping in their histories, with how people are going to relate to issues like animal welfare, whether they too are going to become pet keepers, or whether their cultural backgrounds are going to mean that they are less involved in the practice. One of the things that is pretty clear is that the percentage of American households with children is going down, continues to go down. And twice as many households, percentage-wise, have pets as have children under the age of 18 now, and I think that's a trend that will continue. And what that means is people with more disposable income to spend on themselves and on their animals.
Well, it's great to have a cultural historian look at this. We want to thank you for your perspective.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Catherine. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Catherine Greer is the author of Pets in America. She spoke to us from her office in Wytherthur, Delaware. And if you want more information about the history of pets in America, visit our website at www.callingallpets.org for more information. And now we're ready to take some more of your calls at 1-800-462-7413. And we have someone waiting for us right now, so let's go there. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Jamie calling from Door County.
Jamie, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
That's Door County, Wisconsin, I'll bet.
Yes, it is. We live in Milwaukee, but we're up here for a couple of months this summer. and we have two Labradoodles, which are working out perfectly for us.
And I should just interject for people who
tell
don't
us
know,
what a Labradoodle looks like.
Labradoodles are crosses between Labradors and Standard Poodles.
Right, and we have always had mutts and wanted a mutt-like dog with the vigorousness of being a mutt, getting the best of both breeds, we thought. But mostly we chose it for disposition.
And how's that working out?
Perfect.
So there's no point in us
helping
at all,
right?
Well,
let me tell you, there's one thing.
There's always one thing.
One thing that we just cannot figure out.
What's that?
And that's why I called. I am totally stumped. They have stuffed toys that they cannot sleep without, like their Bankies, you know?
Yeah.
And our male, our big male, who started out at 12 pounds, who is now 80 pounds, has a stuffed toy as large as he is. And when we say it's sleepy time, he runs and finds it wherever he is, and he has to take it to bed with him and sort of nurse on it like a cat will, like pushing his feet against
it. And how old are they?
The dogs are a year and a half, brother and sister.
And you know what? Here's the good news. You don't have a problem at all because they don't have to have a toy every single second. At a year and a half, it's not like they're teething. You know, it's not like they're really young, now the age where they always have to be using their mouth. There's absolutely nothing wrong with them being left for periods of time without something to chew on.
Well, here's the kicker. They treat their bedding the same as these toys.
Ah, there's a kicker here.
All right.
So when we're around, they don't chew on their bedding and they don't chew on their toys. We can even go outside and garden and leave them alone in the house for a couple of hours with the run of the house. They don't chew on anything.
But when you leave the house and drive away.
We crate them, quote unquote, in our bedroom.
Okay.
Because that's the easiest place to shut it off. We cannot leave their bedding in there or their toys because when we've crated them, we've gone out. They're destroyed when we get back.
And you know, they're just not getting the difference between their bedding and their toys. And if the toys, if the stuffed animals are as big as the dogs are, then that sort of makes sense. You know, I mean, I can just see it from their perspective. Is there sort of a big soft thing here and there's a big soft thing over there. So what I would do is I would actually crate train them, crate train them, or else just take their bedding out. You know, most of us think all dogs need to sleep on something soft and cozy, and actually a lot of dogs don't actually even want to or don't need to. So I would either just take the bedding out of the room. If they don't chew on anything else, absolutely no problem. They don't need a special doggy bed. They might when they're 12, you know, but they don't now. Or
they
else,
can sleep on the floor, eh?
They can sleep on the floor. It'll really be okay. Or they could sleep in a crate that doesn't have something soft and chewy on the bottom. I think they'll be just fine.
I think you're right, Patricia.
Don't worry.
Not
a problem. And I should quickly add that there are lots of doodles. We call them doodles, labradoodles out there. And I just want people to know that some of them are calmer than others. They're not all, they're fun and energetic, but they're not, if you want a calm dog, you don't necessarily want to get a doodle because they can be very smart. Well, just full of energy, lots and lots and lots of energy.
Something to remember. And thanks again for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number. We're taking more of your calls next. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets.
Major support for Calling All Pets comes from Dog Tired, the home of American-made premium dog beds, featuring a build-a-bed option where customers choose shapes, fill, size, and fabric options. Designed and tested for man's best friend in Black Earth, Wisconsin. Dog Tired. Information at dawg-tired.com.
You're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, who is America's favorite zoologist.
I always want to laugh when you say that, but I stop myself.
You just seem so.
Maybe I'm your favorite. That would
make
me happy.
You're certainly my favorite. And some others as well. And let's give the number and let those people who think you're the greatest call in. 1-800-462-7413. And I don't know if this person thinks you're the greatest, but
they don't have
to. This person is online, so let's go. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Yes, I'm Maria, and I do think she's the greatest.
Maria, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Miami, Florida. And actually, I got a hold of your program going through Orlando, Florida last week.
Great. Well, I sure hope I can help you.
Yes, I hope so, too, because I have a 2-year-old mix that he's part Rottweiler, part Doberman, and part who knows what else. Huge as a horse.
Yeah.
Wonderful. He thinks he's a little dog and loves to bark at anything that goes by our fence.
Okay.
Not at humans. As a matter of fact, he even let somebody break into our neighbor's yard and thought that that was wonderful. But if it's a dog, no matter what size, even if they're in the sidewalk across the street,
okay,
he just barks, barks, barks.
And is this from the backyard?
Yes.
Okay. And is he out in the backyard a lot by himself?
He's not actually by himself. He's out there right now with 4 other dogs.
And are they out most of the day in the backyard?
No. Just part of the day, but it doesn't matter what time. It could be morning. It
gotcha.
Could be evening. When we let him out in the morning, the minute that the first dog goes by, if it's 6 o'clock in the morning, he'll start barking.
And, of course, he has this quiet, tiny
yeah.
little bark. Is
ruff,
that Roddy Dobie, right? Well, you know, there is something you can do, but it takes some time. And the trick is to teach him an incompatible behavior, meaning that right now when he sees a dog, that's the trigger. It's like a cue. You know, like when you
uh-huh.
say sit and he sits?
Yes.
The word sit. Or a motion of your hand is the cue that makes him sit.
Yes.
Right now, the cue for him to bark is another dog. So
okay.
what you want to teach him is a different response to that same cue. So what you're going to do is you're going to organize a bag of really great, wonderful, tasty treats. I would leave the other dogs inside the house.
Okay.
Because otherwise it's going to be pretty chaotic
yeah.
for a while. And what you're going to do is you're going to go outside with him and first of all, when there's no dog around, when he looks away from you, you're going to say, watch. And then when he looks at your face, you're going to say, good boy, instantly, as soon as his head turns,
uh-huh.
and then you're going to give him a treat.
Okay.
So you're teaching him when you say watch, if he turns and looks at your face, he gets a treat. Does all this make sense? Larry's,
yes.
Larry's nodding.
I'm nodding.
Uh-huh.
It makes
Larry's
sense
nodding.
To me.
Yes, I'm
okay.
nodding too.
Good, good, good. But that's just phase one, and that only needs to last a couple of days. Phase
okay.
two is one of the really important stages in which what you're going to do is you're going to go outside. He's by himself, no other dogs, and he's going to see another dog and try and do it when another dog is a long way away. Don't wait till they're like right in front of the
okay.
fence or something. And the second he looks at that dog, you're going to say, watch. And you're going to be real close to him. If he turns his head when you say watch, you're going to say, good boy. And you're going to give him a treat.
Okay.
If he doesn't, you're going to be ready. You're going to take that treat in your fingers and you're going to move it right away down right in front of his nose, a half an inch from his nostrils.
Okay.
And you're going to lure him like a donkey in a carrot 180 degrees away from the dog, back towards the house. And as you do, as his head turns, even though you're the one who's creating the head
uh-huh.
turn, good boy, treat.
Okay.
So that's phase two, and you do that a lot. Now, here's the key. Phase three, this is the money.
This is the jackpot.
This is the jackpot. The jackpot, I should say, is you're going to do this every time he looks at the other dog. You're going to say watch and then give him a treat. And what's going to happen is he'll instantly look back at the other dog, right?
Uh-huh.
You say watch again. That's fine. You say watch again. You give him a treat when his head turns. Do that repeatedly over and over and over again as this dog walks closer and closer to your fence. And what you're going to do is you actually are going to give him a jackpot, which is like 10 treats in a row. Good boy, treat. Good boy, treat. Good boy, treat.
Okay.
When he turns his head without you saying watch. In other words, rather than your word watch being the cue, the dog approaching is
okay.
the cue that gets him mm-hmm. to turn his head. And that's what you want, because you don't want to have to say watch every time. You want him to learn, if I see another dog and I run to the door, she might give me a treat. So,
oh,
does all of this make sense?
Yes, it sure does.
The trick is it's going to take some time, and you have mm-hmm. to work him up gradually, and don't just expect that you can let him out in the yard. You know, you do a session with you 2 feet away from him, and then him let him loose in the yard with you in the house and the other 5 dogs out there.
Right.
And then you yell from the door, watch. It's not going to work. You know,
it's
you're going to have
work.
To work your way up.
Good luck. And
good
thanks.
Luck.
And I like that jack part. You know, it's the
jackpot.
You said jackpot part, but it's you could just shorten it to jack part.
Instead
of jackpot part, it's the jack part.
Absolutely. See, that's what I meant to do, Larry. You see, I was actually ahead of you.
You were ahead of the game.
Right. And if you believe that, I have a bridge, Mueller, that's for sale.
We have an email, by the way.
We do.
A question from a listener named Beth from Appleton, Wisconsin.
Okay.
She says she's going to be traveling to Denver soon. She has a chocolate lab, and while in Denver, they'll be visiting someone who has a 2-year-old Great Dane. Beth wonders if she should be concerned about one or both of the dogs wanting to mark their territory. These dogs have never met. They won't have the opportunity to meet until it is time for them to share a living space.
Mm-hmm.
What can Beth do to make this introduction go as smooth as possible?
That's a very good question, and there are actually a lot of different aspects to this. And one is scent marking, and the other is how are the dogs going to get along. So one of the things to do is to be sure to introduce the dogs outside. Ideally, they would be in an area that's got a lot of open space around it. You know, dogs mm-hmm. can feel pressure. You know, if you're in an enclosed
yeah.
space, you just sort of feel it. It adds a little pressure. When you're in a big open area, you feel a little expansive. Dogs seem to react the same way. So ideally, there would be a yard, or actually, ideally, there'd be somebody else's fenced yard.
Right.
So the dogs would be introduced on neutral territory. You can't always do that, but if you can, that's ideal. Otherwise, do the introduction outside. If the dogs have been good with other dogs in the past, and be sure that you're specific about what kind of other dogs. So if one dog is always great with other females, but he's never met other males, then, you know, we don't know how his behavior towards females is going to generalize towards his behavior towards males. But let's assume that these dogs, since I can't ask her, let's assume that these dogs have had good interactions with other dogs. They're not dog-dog aggressive. They're comfortable in social interactions. I would introduce them outside. If they've been very good in the past, I would have them off-leash or on loose leashes, or one dog on a loose leash and the other with a leash dropped. What you want to avoid is tugging on the leash such that both of you are holding onto the leashes and putting tension on the leash, because that actually puts tension on the leash.
Yeah.
You know, tension in a physical and a psychological way
sure.
as well. Those things both go together. And you also want to avoid, which is very easy to do, sort of standing around staring at them, not moving because you're a little nervous with your eyes sort of big and round. That's all a sign of potential aggression to a dog. So stay loose. Don't sort of loom over them. Keep your body a little bit away. And then just have them do their marking outside.
Yeah, let them and smell each other's butts and all
let
that.
Let them greet the way dogs greet. Let them smell. If one of the things you want to guard against or be on the lookout for are two dogs who are sniffing each other but are both motionless. They're motionless, they're stiff, their mouths are closed. That's a sign of potential trouble. And if that happens, what you want to do is do not go towards them and grab a collar. That is a dog fight. You're going to turn, ironically, away from them. Clap, hey guys, let's go on a walk. Clap, okay, let's go. Want to go on a walk? Do you want your something? You know,
yeah.
take all of the pressure away from them. Move away from where they are to pull them away from each other. So that's the most important part about the greeting. And the marking, unless there's a marking problem in the house, as long as they have a lot of chance to leave their calling cards everywhere, communicate through scent outside, they'll probably be fine inside.
Wonderful. By the way, how do people email us questions?
We love to hear questions from you and tips and ideas that you've had. Send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to call, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Audrey from Anchorage, Alaska.
Hey, Audrey, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
I have a catch-me-if-you-can problem with my border collie.
Oh, that great game.
He's 7.5 years old and has been on house arrest for the last 3 months because of a disc problem in his back. And at this point, the vet wants him to be swimming for rehab, so I've been taking him to the local dog park to swim. The problem is that once I let him off lead, he never wants to stop swimming.
Oh, one of those obsessive swimmers?
Yes.
Oh, dear.
He's lightning fast and always manages to be just outside my reach.
Right. Uh-huh.
The only time that I can catch him is when he's completely exhausted and allows me to catch him. So
That's probably a little over what the vet recommended.
Right.
Total exhaustion.
Right.
Is the setup where I don't have a vision of where he's actually doing his swimming. You can't get a... Is this a pond or a lake? Or
It's a big lake. There's kind of a sandy, muddy beach area that goes out maybe about 20 feet.
Okay.
That's shallow before they...
I was just wondering if you could go out into some kind of a flotation device and then have him on a long lead to get away from the brush that would catch up the lead.
Hmm. I haven't tried that. My one thing I'm concerned about is that the swimming itself isn't something that he does. He's always swimming towards something like a frisbee or a stick. He's very oriented toward some job.
Okay. Well, that's something you might be able to use to your advantage. What if you start a training program where you gradually start teaching him without getting him in situations in which he can just sort of ignore you, but maybe he's on a long line or something, but you start teaching him that it's to his advantage to come back to you. I mean, one of the ways to do that, frankly, is to call him back to you, get him physically, you know, if you mm-hmm. have to haul him in, you know, very gently on the line, and then give him what he wants, and that might be you throw a frisbee for him to go after. You don't really have a choice except to sort of gently ease him in, and then what he gets for coming is he gets to go swim some more.
So that's a great idea.
Do you see
idea.
What I mean? Try and change the consequence of being called to come, especially with a smart dog who's highly motivated. That might be what helps you out.
Yeah. Great. I'll try that.
All right.
Good
thanks.
Luck.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, I had so much fun. Should we do this again next week?
Oh, no.
I think we should.
Actually, I think we will. I have fun too, Larry.
I did too. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is a production at Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
For a copy of today's show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0512P and bring out the best in your pet with advice from Trisha's dog training books. If you need help training your new dog, or if you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, information is available online. Visit our website at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
On the next Calling All Pets, find out why it's important to keep Nemo in the fish tank.
And we'll also talk with author Temple Grandin about how she uses the mysteries of autism to decode animal behavior.
Tune in for that and answers to your animal behavior questions on the very next Calling All Pets.